geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers. Welcome back to Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Okay, so this week, I thought I'd try something new and start out with a new segment. But before I get into that, I just wanted to give a shout out to my boy, Entropy in Motion. I've talked about him before. I've talked about his albums before on a previous broadcast. But I still feel like he hasn't gotten the recognition he deserves. He has two new albums out. One as Entropy in Motion, and the other as once again, I'm gonna butcher this fucking band name, but Sisanya or whatever the fuck it's called. Sorry, buddy. Once again, I tried. But it's spelled Czna. And once again, I just really feel like he doesn't get the recognition he deserves, and you should really check out his music. As I've said in a past episode, he has a similar vibe to me, even though I'm more on the heavier side than he is, but his music's still good, so you should check it out. Anyway, on to this new segment. I'm going to call it Weekly Horror News, and it's just articles for the week, or news articles for the week that, about the world of horror and what's going on in it that I found interesting. I'm not going to read the whole articles. Most of the time I'll just read a headline about it. But anyway, the first thing I wanted to talk about was in the 1980s, there was an anthology series, Freddy's Nightmares, which was based on the Nightmare on Elm Street, movies, of course. It didn't do very well for whatever reason when it was first on TV, even though Freddy is a horror icon. The show just didn't really cut it, and it's really hard to find episodes. I mean, they're not streaming anywhere. There aren't really any box sets or, you know, like separate seasons of the show. So fans of the show couldn't really get what they were looking for. Like I said, it's not streaming anywhere until now. Screambox is now streaming every single episode of the series. And it's currently the only streaming service that is doing this. So if you have any interest in watching that old show, Freddy's not really in it. He kind of introduces each episode, but it really doesn't have anything to do with the Nightmare on Elm Street series per se. I've seen a couple episodes here and there where I can't remember. I think it was on some streaming site that isn't exactly legal, so I'm not going to say the name of it. But that was years ago, so I can't really remember. But Scream, like I said, the entire series is now streaming on Screambox. It's not free, however. The service costs money, but it's only like $5 a month. So if you have that money, the $5 to spare a month, you should definitely check it out. From what I can remember, it's worth the watch at least once. And next up, Netflix is teaming up with Blumhouse Television to produce a new true crime docuseries, Worst Roommate Ever, which involves people living with violent con artists, stone cold killers, and they're all true stories. And they unveil some of the worst cohabitation experiences one could ever imagine. Which means that the 5-part documentary is basically going to highlight 4 harrowing tales of seemingly harmless roommates turning into real-life nightmares for their unsuspecting victims when their malevolent and sometimes violent intentions are revealed. And like I said, this is a true crime documentary series, which seems like it might be kind of interesting, even though, quite honestly, Blumhouse has been known to put out some pretty shitty movies recently, so who knows how this is gonna turn out. And apparently John Carpenter is gonna be coming out with the sequel to his original The Thing, which was in turn a remake of an old sci-fi classic from the 50s, I think it was. But Carpenter's remake is pretty fucking awesome. And if you've never seen it, you definitely should see it. So hopefully, if the sequel does come to be, it's just as good as Carpenter's original. And speaking of remakes, Netflix just released a Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel on its own, which I've seen and quite honestly don't even bother watching it. It pretty much sucks. However, Netflix reported that 29 million hours of the movie were watched by subscribers during the first weekend that the movie was released, which really surprises me, because, like I said, it's really not a good movie, which seems to be kind of the trend for the franchise, which, in my opinion, once again, only had two movies or two good movies in it, and a third that's okay. And that was, of course, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, and the Leatherface prequel, which was released back in 2016 or 2017, I believe. But yeah, in my opinion, those are the only three movies worth watching in the franchise. And definitely this one, the Netflix version, really isn't worth your time watching. And that does it for this week's horror news. And now, what I'm sure you're all here to actually listen to me talk about, this week I decided to do an episode on the found footage horror movie franchise VHS. I've made it quite clear in previous episodes that I'm really not a fan of the horror subgenre. Found footage. I think most of them suck. But VHS is actually decent. I'm not going to say all the movies in this franchise are good, but there are some that are worth watching. And what makes the VHS franchise different from all the other found footage horror movies out there is that these are actually anthologies, which is quite rare in the found footage subgenre, like I said. Horror anthologies are usually pretty hit or miss. Some of the stories work, and some of them don't. But in this franchise, a good majority of the stories that are told do work. And having said that, we are going to kick it right off with 2012's VHS.
This house, and all we have to do is steal this one VHS tape.
Found it.
You got it?
Yeah.
Which one is it?
I don't know, man. Let's just look at these tapes, okay?
What's so special about this tape, anyway?
Can we get a shot of this?
What's with this camera?
Thank you.
The movie opens with Tape 56, which is basically the wraparound story, and it's directed by Adam Wingard. But the narrative focuses on a criminal gang who films their exploits, which includes smashing the walls, windows, and light fixtures of an abandoned house, and sexually assaulting a woman in a parking lot in a pretty disturbing scene. You know, most things in horror movies don't really, you know, bother me. But that particular part kinda did. But anyway, an anonymous source offers them a large sum of money to break into a house and steal a single VHS videotape. The gang accepts their task, eager to expand their criminal enterprises. Upon entering the house, the criminals find the corpse of an old man sitting in front of several televisions, playing white noise. While the other criminals are free to roam the house, one of them stays behind in the TV room with the dead body to watch a tape left in the VCR. The contents of the tape and the four subsequent ones compromise the bulk of the film, with the action cutting back and forth to the criminals' efforts between each short. And then the first proper story, Amateur Night, which is directed by David Bruckner, opens with Shane, Patrick, and Clint, who are three friends who have rented a motel room to fulfill Shane's intent of bringing women back there for sex. Clint is wearing glasses that have been outfitted with a hidden camera and microphone that will allow them to turn their planned encounter into an amateur porno night. While the three men are bar hopping, Clint encounters Lily, a mysterious young woman who appears unusually shy and says little other than, "I like you." In addition to picking up Lily, the men also succeed in convincing another young woman, Barfly Lisa, to return to their motel room with them. Lisa passes out as Shane attempts to initiate sex with Patrick, laughing, discouraging him from continuing. Lily then continues awkwardly coming on to Clint, but it is Shane who comes on to her instead. Clint notices that Lily's feet are clawed and have scales as he undresses her, but Shane and Patrick are oblivious. Lily then appears responsive, pushing Shane onto his back and then beginning to undress Clint, seemingly beginning a threesome. Overwhelmed, Clint goes to the bathroom, and Patrick disrobes and attempts to take Clint's place, but Lily has made it clear that she dislikes Patrick. Moments later, Patrick bursts into the bathroom with a large cut on his hand, claiming that Lily bit him. When they approach Shane, Lily suddenly sprouts fangs, then attacks and kills Shane. Clint and Patrick hide in the bathroom until Patrick, still nude, arms himself with the shower curtain rod and returns to the room. Clint then tries to wake Lisa as Patrick attempts to fight Lily, but she subdues and pounces on him, drinking his blood and ripping off his genitals. In a pretty cool practical effect, it actually made me wince, and it's pretty realistic, but it's a pretty good effect. Anyway, Clint escapes the room, but ends up falling down the stairwell, breaking his wrist in the process. Lily then catches up to Clint, but instead of attacking, she attempts to perform fellatio. And if you don't know what that means, she basically tries to give him head. Due to his pain and fear, Clint is unresponsive, which upsets Lily. She then crawls over to a corner and cries softly, and her cries grow louder, but then turn into demonic growls. Clint runs away, begging bystanders for help, but he is suddenly lifted into the sky by Lily, who has transformed into a winged creature. This reveals that Lily was some sort of demonic entity, likely a succubus, who was on the hunt for a mate. The video glasses fall off Clint's face as Lily carries him away and hit the ground before the video cuts out. We then cut back to the wraparound story, where one of the criminals discovers that Brad, the person who stayed to watch the tape, is missing. Meanwhile, the other criminals search the basement and discover hundreds of unmarked VHS tapes and begin collecting them all to ensure they get the right one. One of them manages to catch a glimpse of a strange figure wandering off when they gather the tapes. While the criminal is still upstairs, Rox replaces the tape in the VCR with a different one and settles down to watch it. Before I go on to the next segment, I'm going to say that this first story, Amateur Night, was actually turned into a spin-off movie called Siren, which I will get in or get into near the end of this episode. But before then, we go to Second Honeymoon, which is directed by Ty West. Sam and Stephanie are a married couple traveling to Arizona for their honeymoon, with Stephanie recording and documenting everything along the way. That night, they visit a Wild West-themed attraction known as Wild West Junction, where Stephanie receives a prediction from a mechanical fortune teller dressed as a prospector. And the prediction claims that she will soon be happily reunited with a loved one, and that she is also very trusting and is easily taken advantage of. Sometime later, a strange woman comes to Sam and Stephanie's motel room and awkwardly tries to convince Sam off-camera to give her a ride somewhere the next day. In the middle of the night, while the couple are asleep, a mysterious stranger breaks into the room, turns on the camcorder, and films himself stroking Stephanie's ass with a switchblade. The intruder then also steals the $100 from Sam's wallet and dips his toothbrush in the toilet. The next day, on their way to visit the Grand Canyon, Sam notices the missing money and accuses Stephanie of taking it, but she assures him that she didn't. That night, the stranger re-enters the room again and repeatedly stabs Sam in the neck with a switchblade, filming him as he chokes to death on his own blood. The camera then shows the killer, the woman from earlier, wearing a porcelain mask, cleaning the blade while she and Stephanie make out passionately, revealing that the woman was Stephanie's lover. The recording cuts to Stephanie and her lover driving away, while with Stephanie asking her lover if she has erased the footage. This one is, how do I put it? It's kind of disturbing. Actually, it's really kind of disturbing to understand why you'd have to watch this segment. But it's still pretty good. We then once again cut back to the wraparound, where Rex is left confused by what he has witnessed. Unknown to him, though, the old man's corpse has disappeared. While back in the basement, the other criminals debate on why the tape they are after is so special, and also plan to make copies of it so they can make a little extra money. The film then transitions to the next story, which is Tuesday the 17th, which is the weakest story in this movie. Directed by Glenn McQuaid, the story involves a group of 20-somethings, Joey, Spider, and Samantha, accompanying their new friend Wendy on her annual trip to a lake located in a nearby forest. Joey films the group as Wendy leads them through the woods, occasionally mentioning accidents that took the lives of her friends. When the camera scans certain areas, glitched images of mutilated bodies appear in the film. They also discover the mutilated corpse of a pig nearby, shortly before Wendy mentions that everyone is going to die. Relaxing and smoking weed by the lake, Wendy tells the others that the lake is the same place where a murderer killed many people years earlier, but the group laughs it off as a joke. Spider and Samantha then leave the group for a bathroom break, when suddenly Samantha is killed when a knife is launched into her face. Spider attempts to run, but is stabbed in the head repeatedly by the unknown culprit, and a strange figure with a featureless red head obscured in tracking errors, known as the Glitch, wanders around. Back at the lake, Joey asks Wendy where Spider and Samantha went, to which she answers that they left, then awkwardly asks if he wants to have sex. Joey guesses that Wendy was serious about the story she had been telling them about the murders, mentioning that he remembers hearing about it himself. Dropping the facade, Wendy reveals that she had been to the lake before, where the murderer slaughtered all of her friends, leaving her as the only survivor. She notes that the police did not believe her when she said that the killer could be in two places at once, and Wendy then tells Joey that she lured all three of them to the woods to use as bait, so that she can find and kill the Glitch. As the two talk, the Glitch walks up behind Joey and slits his throat. Wendy then runs away, luring the Glitch into a pit trap, then into a bear trap, which traps it momentarily. She tries filming the Glitch up close, but it continues to be obscured by the tracking errors and slashes at her hand. Wendy then continues to run through the woods, warning anyone who finds the tape never to come to the area. She then finds Joey in his death throes and watches as he dies. The Glitch then approaches Wendy before a bed of spikes impales it, and Wendy gloats at the Glitch and walks away, but when she turns around, it's gone. It then reappears in a tree and pounces on Wendy, beating her to death with the camera in a pretty nasty kill, then slashes her stomach, subsequently eviscerating her. Wendy's corpse is last seen twitching and shuddering violently as the camera glitches out, revealing that she is becoming a glitch herself. Like I said, this is probably the weakest story in the movie, even though it has some pretty good kills with some good practical effects. It's not that the story is bad. It's pretty derivative, and it's quite obvious that it's ripping off Friday the 13th and any other major slasher movies that takes place in a camp, like Sleepaway Camp, that came out of the 80s. We then cut back to the wraparound story, where the old man's body has returned to the room, but Rox now is nowhere to be seen. The remaining criminals, Zach and Gary, are confused as to where the others have gone, with Gary telling Zach to look through the tapes. Zach replaces the current tape with a new one and sits down to watch The Sick Thing That Happened to Emily When She Was Younger. Directed by Joe Swanberg, this is told entirely through a series of computer video chats, kind of like Unfriended. Emily tells her boyfriend James, an aspiring actor, about a strange bump on her arm and how it reminds her of an accident she had when she was younger. After showing James around her apartment, Emily hears noises outside her door, and she goes to and after investigating the room, Emily witnesses a small, ghostly, childlike entity rush into her room and slam the door shut, leading her to believe that her apartment is haunted. Hearing the noises again the next night, Emily attempts to investigate some more, only to discover the entity once again when she turns on the light. She questions her landlord about the disturbances, but the landlord claims that no children have ever lived in the apartment complex, nor have any people ever died there, but Emily is unconvinced. During her next video chat with James, Emily nonchalantly digs into the bump on her arm with the scalpel and a meat fork to find out what exactly the bump is, but James urges her to stop before the wound becomes infected, promising to check on it himself when he arrives in a week. The next night, Emily attempts to contact the strange child. She closes her eyes and carries her laptop to have James look out for the being, and the ghostly child appears once again, along with a similarly ghostly young girl. The children manage to knock her unconscious as James quickly appears in her apartment, and the children are revealed to not be ghosts, but rather aliens, watching as James surgically removes an alien fetus from Emily's torso, revealing that they are using Emily as an incubator for alien-human hybrids. James, who has been working with the aliens and removing the fetuses for some time, questions the aliens how much longer they plan to do this to Emily, mentioning to them that the arm bump is a tracking device. The aliens then erase Emily's memory, while James breaks some of her bones to make it look like an accident again. In their next chat, a badly injured Emily believes that she has sustained her injuries after wandering into traffic in a fugue state, and reveals that the doctor James recommended has diagnosed her as schizoaffective, and tearfully says that James deserves a better, more normal girlfriend. James assures Emily that she is the only person he wants to be with, but once their chat ends, he begins a new chat with a different woman. This woman has the same bump on her arm and also believes that James is her boyfriend, revealing that the aliens are using multiple people as incubators. This is probably my second least favorite story in the movie, just because it's really fucking weird. And it's kind of a riff on Unfriended, which I really didn't like, either the first or the second movie in that, I guess, franchise, if that's what you want to call it. If this story had been done better, it could have been more interesting, but it's really not, and it's pretty derivative, and like I said, just fucking weird. We then cut back to the wraparound story once again, where both Zach and the old man's corpse are gone, and Gary, now the only one left, searches the rooms upstairs. He finds the decapitated remains of Zach and is subsequently attacked by the old man, who has become a zombie. Gary attempts to flee downstairs, but he falls and twists his ankle and is killed by the zombie. The wraparound ends with the camera left in the TV room picking up the sound of the VCR starting the last tape by itself. Which leads us into the last story, 10/31/98, which is directed by Radio Silence. And the movie, or the story, opens on Halloween night 1998, where Tyler, dressed as a teddy bear implanted with a nanny cam, meets his friends Chad, Matt, and Paul, dressed as a Unabomber, a pirate, and a marine, as they head out to a Halloween party at a friend's house, only to end up at the wrong place. Thinking that they are the first ones to arrive, the quartet sneaks inside, and they begin to experience paranormal phenomena, but believe that they are at a realistic haunted house attraction and have fun with it. While in the attic, they find several men gathered around a young woman, whom they have suspended from the rafters, apparently performing an exorcism. The men happen to be chanting "Cast you down" towards a woman, and the boys exuberantly join in. This alerts the group to their presence, and they turn around, basically say, "What the fuck are you doing here?" And then proceed to physically assault the young woman, causing some of the men to be pulled upwards into the darkness by an unseen force. More violent, overtly threatening paranormal phenomenon then begin to occur as the boys initially flee, but they realize that they should try to rescue the girl. Returning to the attic, the boys work to untie her and get her to safety. When the girl is freed, the house comes to life with poltergeist activity, with ghostly arms rising from the walls and the floors to claim the lives of the woman's captors. Escaping through the basement, the boys pile into their car with the girl and drive away. The car abruptly stops and the girl disappears, reappearing in the street before them and walking away in a demonic form amid a flock of birds. The boys then realize that the car has stopped on train tracks, and they attempt to get out of the car as a train approaches, but they are unable to start the car or unlock the doors, and the train smashes into the car off-camera, killing all inside. However, don't worry, there is an alternative ending to this story, where a joke ending was shot in one take by Radio Silence, in which the doors are unlocked and the boys get out just before the train smashes into their car. The boys then walk away and talk about how much fun they had and what a crazy night it was. Meanwhile, the train hits the car and it explodes behind them as they walk away. And as the movie ends, clips from tape 56 play throughout the credits. This is one of those movies that it's better to watch in a large pitch black room with deafening surround sound going on, and a group of people just as scared as you are. Like I said earlier, some of the segments are better than others, and trust me, you'll know which ones. But overall, VHS is one of the most imaginative, jolting films I've or anthology horror films, at least, that I've seen in a while. If you like Creepshow 1 and 2, Tales from the Dark Side, Twilight Zone the movie, and some Stephen King adaptations, you should enjoy this. The acting, for the most part, well, for 98% of the movie, is actually a lot better than it should be. There is some gore, and the practical effects in this are actually really good and fun to watch. And like I said, I think this is probably the best installment in the franchise. This had a budget of $242,000 and brought in $1.9 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 5.8 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes at 57%, Letterboxd 3 out of 5, and I give it a 3.5 out of 5. And that leads us into the first sequel, 2013's VHS 2.
So what's the deal now?
Just this woman thinks her son is missing.
Doesn't look like anyone's home. Here, look at this.
These tapes only affect you if you play it in a correct sequence.
Don't let go, man!
This, of course, opens with the wraparound story, this time called Tape 49, where a college student's mother requests that Larry, a private investigator, and his girlfriend Aisha, also a private investigator, look into the disappearance of her son Kyle. After breaking into Kyle's residence, they discover a large number of televisions displaying white noise, a stack of VHS tapes, and a laptop that is currently recording a video that also contains the tapes from the previous film, including tape 56. On the laptop recording, Kyle discusses the VHS tapes, saying where he got one of the most recent ones. Larry then tells Aisha to watch the tapes while he inspects the house, and as Aisha picks up a tape, inserts it into the VCR, and begins to watch, a figure peers out from the shadows and watches her. And that leads us into the first story, or the first tape, if you will, Phase 1, Clinical Trials, directed by Adam Wingard. This opens with Harry Middleton sitting in a doctor's office as a doctor examines his camera. The camera is fitted into an ocular implant that has replaced Herman's right eye after it was damaged in a car accident. The doctor then informs Herman that the camera will record and monitor everything he does for research purposes, and that there is no way to turn it off during this time. Herman is also told that he may experience some quote-unquote glitches, as the implant is still in its experimental stage. As he leaves the clinic, Herman notices a young red-haired girl staring at him intently. And then returning home, Herman passes time by playing video games and eventually gets up for tea. He returns from the kitchen to find his game controller far from where he originally left it, followed by the tea kettle crashing to the ground suddenly. Later, Herman also sees what appears to be a figure lying beneath the sheets of his bed, but when he pulls back the sheets, the bed is empty. Herman then finds himself face to face with the bleeding man who appears to be dead, causing him to flee to the bathroom. After phoning his doctor, freaking out, to complain about what happened, Herman emerges from the bathroom and encounters a man again, this time with a young girl who also appears to be dead. Returning back to the bathroom, Herman is then disturbed by repeated banging on a door and ends up sleeping in the bathtub overnight. The next morning, Herman emerges from the bathroom as everything seems to be normal, although his room is in more disarray than the night before. Later, the red-haired girl from the hospital appears once again at his door and requests to be let in, as she too is experiencing a similar situation. Given her name as Clarissa, she explains that she was born deaf and had a cochlear implant installed in her ear, giving her the ability to hear new frequencies, including ghosts of dead people. Herman suggests removing the implant to make the ghosts go away, but Clarissa says that doing so will only keep Herman from seeing the ghosts. As Clarissa claims that the ghosts will get stronger and more dangerous the longer one pays attention to them, an overweight underwear-clad man appears behind her. Herman tries to alert her to his presence, but Clarissa says she already knows he is there and that he is her uncle, who according to her wasn't a nice person. Clarissa then starts to fuck Herman to divert his attention away from the ghosts. Sometime later, Herman awakens and sees Clarissa sleeping on a couch. He finds a young girl in his bed and flees, before witnessing Clarissa being dragged into the pool by an unseen entity. Despite Herman's best effort to save her, Clarissa ends up drowning, and running back through the house in an attempt to escape the ghost, Herman once again locks himself in the bathroom and uses a straight razor to cut out the implant. The ghosts of Clarissa and her uncle appear in the bathroom as Herman tries to escape it, but he unwittingly runs directly into the ghosts of the man and young girl, with the former choking him. The man grabs the implant and shoves it deep into Herman's throat, presumably killing him. And then we cut back to the wraparound story, where Aisha calls Larry into the room where they discuss the tape's legitimacy. Larry tells Aisha to continue viewing the tapes, and she continues playing Kyle's video, where he explains that the tapes must be watched in a proper sequence to affect you. Aisha then finds a new tape, inserts it into the VCR, and proceeds to watch it, which cuts into the next story, A Ride in the Park, which is directed by Eduardo Sanchez and Greg Hale. After answering a call from his girlfriend, Amy, cyclist Mike Sullivan affixes a camera to his helmet and goes on a bike ride through the woods of the state park. Suddenly, Mike runs into a hysterical, injured, blood-covered woman, begging him to help her boyfriend before she begins vomiting blood. Mike then sees several zombies approaching them before the woman suddenly turns into a zombie herself and bites Mike on the throat. After he manages to kill the woman, Mike staggers through the woods, heavily bleeding, before he too vomits blood, collapses, and apparently dies. Later on, a pair of bikers, a man and a woman, come across him and attempt to call for help, but Mike reanimates, attacks, and kills the man before proceeding to watch the woman run into the woods. He then begins devouring the man as the woman returns, having become a zombie as well. She joins Mike in devouring the man before he too reanimates, and hearing noise in the distance, the three zombies head off towards it. The source of the noise happens to be a young girl's birthday party, and the zombified trio invade the party, killing several people, some of whom reanimate to attack the others. While trying to attack a man and his three daughters in their car, Mike notices his bloodied reflection in their car window, which seems to subdue his aggressive behavior. When he accidentally pocket dials Amy, he is shocked back to a semi-conscious state upon hearing her voice. And then regaining some of his humanity, Mike kills himself with a discarded shotgun. Back in the wraparound, Larry re-enters the room and finds Aisha staring at the TV in a hypnotized state with her nose bleeding. Larry is able to wake her from her trance, and Aisha says she has a migraine. Larry then leaves once again to find medicine as a seemingly entranced Aisha proceeds to pick up a new tape and insert it into the VCR. As she watches, the figure from the earlier crawls out from the shadows and watches her once again. This segment, A Ride in the Park, it's probably the weakest one in the movie, although it does have a good amount of gore, but it just isn't a very good story. Anyway, the third story, Safe Haven, directed by Timo, I'm not even going to try to pronounce her last name, and Gareth Evans, opens in Indonesia, where a film crew composed of four members, Malik the interviewer, Lena the producer, and also Malik's fiance, Malik's best friend Adam, and Joni the cameraman, infiltrate a cult known as Paradise Gates in the hope of shooting a documentary about their mysterious activities with numerous cameras, both displayed and hidden. The film crew are invited inside the cult's compound by a woman known as Madam. Inside, they find the walls adorned in bizarre symbols, school children in classrooms, and women dressed in white garments. The crew meets with and interviews the leader of the cult, a man referred to as Father. During the interview, Lena becomes ill and steps out, and while searching for a spare camera battery, Malik overhears a private conversation between Lena and Adam, where Lena reveals that she is pregnant with Adam's child. In the basement, Adam finds a woman with her womb carved out and strapped to a chair. The woman awakens and begins screaming and convulsing, causing him to run away. While Father is being interviewed, a bell chimes and he is suddenly announces the time of reckoning over the intercom. The cultists then begin a mass suicide via poison and gunshots, while Joni has his throat cut by Father after repeatedly interrupting the announcement. Alina is abducted by several women in surgical apparel, and Malik is shot dead by one of the cult members. As Adam attempts to rescue Lena, an explosion knocks him back, and after watching a person crawl across the ceiling, he stands and attempts to advance into the fiery room until only to be intercepted by Father, covered in blood with the cult symbol written on it, who then proceeds to explode into a cloud of blood and organs. Adam finds Lena, who has the cult symbol carved into her skin, placed on the altar, and he manages to kill Madam, but is unable to save Lena, watching as the horned demon the cult worship, which resembles the Baphomet, tear its way out of her body. As Adam attempts to flee, he is attacked by the previously deceased cultists and schoolchildren, including Joni and Malik, who have all turned into zombie-like ghouls. As he finally manages to get outside and get into the car, he drives off, only to be rammed by the demon and seriously injured. As he crawls out of the car's wreckage, the demon looks down on Adam before calling him Papa, and the revelation that the demon is in fact his child drives Adam insane. He laughs hysterically, and the camera starts to malfunction. And then once again, going back to the wraparound, Larry re-enters the room with Madison, only to discover Aisha is dead, having killed herself with the gun. A VHS tape with the word "watch" written on it in lipstick lies beside her, and Larry picks up the tape for some reason, instead of freaking out that his fucking partner is fucking dead, inserts it in the VCR, and anxiously watches it. Which brings us to the last story, Slumber Party Alien Abduction, which is directed by Jason Eisner. Brothers Gary and Randy attach a camera to their Yorkshire Terrier Tang to create videos at their lakeside house. Their parents leave on a romantic getaway, giving them a list of chores in the process. After their parents leave, Gary and Randy invite their friends Sean and Danny to the house so the group can harass the brother's older sister Jen, her boyfriend Zach, and her friends. While the group is swimming at a nearby lake, ambushing Jen and her friends with squirt guns filled with piss, they fail to notice a gray alien hiding behind or beneath the water. Later that night, the group startled Jen and Zach during sex by blaring loud music and flashing lights, and then a deafening noise is heard, but the group does not notice. In retaliation, Jen and Zach attach another camera to Tank as they catch one of the boys masturbating to a porno. Afterwards, the deafening noise is heard once again, as the power then turns out. Seeing a figure outside the door, Zach goes to grab Gary and Randy's father's gun, when suddenly Zach is grabbed by the alien from earlier, along with others of its kind, who are revealed to be the cause of the disturbances. The aliens then abduct the rest of the group, sealing them in their sleeping bags and attempting to drown them in the lake. Only Gary, Randy, Jen, and Tank are able to escape, running in the woods to hide. After Tank inadvertently alerts the aliens to their location by barking, their group run towards what they believe to be police lights and sirens, but it turns out to be a trap set up by the aliens, who abduct Randy. Jen and Gary run away to a nearby barn, where the aliens drag Jen away as Gary and Tank escape up a ladder. As the aliens close in on Gary, he is suddenly pulled into the air by the alien ship's tractor beam, and as Gary is pulled into the air, his group loosens on Tank's leash, and Tank falls down the ladder to the floor, the impact loosening the camera from his back. Mortally injured by the fall, Tank whimpers as he and the camera both slowly die. Aww, nobody likes when a fucking dog dies in a horror movie, and this is no exception. Tank is actually pretty cool, and it's kind of sad when he does end up dying. But anyway, that leads us into the final part of the wraparound story, where after watching the tape, Larry watches the webcam footage and sees Kyle explain that he and his mother want to make their own tape. Kyle then attempts suicide on camera by shooting himself through his jaw, but survives with his lower jaw shattered in the process and runs off moments before Larry and Aisha enter the house. As Larry watches it, an undead Aisha suddenly rises and attacks him, and in self-defense, Larry breaks her neck and rushes into the other room as Aisha chases after him on all fours. Larry hides in a closet and shoots Aisha in the face when she finds him, and hears a strange gurgling sound, and explores the closet, only to find Kyle has been hiding in the closet the whole time. Kyle lunges at Larry and strangles him to death, and afterward, Kyle just gives the camera a thumbs up, revealing the plan he and his mother came up with being a success, before turning off the camera and the movie ending. Although the critics really seemed to like this movie and called it better than the first VHS, I disagree. This one, it's not awful, but it's not anywhere near as good as the first film in the franchise. While there are segments in the first film that I would watch again, there's not one in this that I would rewatch, not one segment that deserved to make it past the pitch stage, and it's just really a complete money grab to capitalize off the relatively good word of mouth from the first film. Like I said, it's not a terrible film. It's just not anywhere near as good. While the first film did definitely have its flaws, this one has a hell of a lot more. And this would be proven when it only brought in $805,574 at the box office when it had a budget of $350,000. IMDb gave this a 6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes, a surprising 71%. Letterboxd, a 3 out of 5. And I give it a 2.5 out of 5. And that leads us into 2014's VHS Viral.
I love it when you record me. No, really, I do.
Tape that you brought into us. Where did you find that tape?
There's a secret compartment. The breaker box.
Want to see whose video gets more hits?
We once again open up with the wraparound story, this one called Vicious Circles, where Kevin, an amateur videographer, constantly shoots footage of his girlfriend, Iris. At first she claims to enjoy it, but then grows annoyed and concerned with their boyfriend's obsession with filming her. It also becomes apparent that Kevin lives with his abusive grandmother, who at one point bloodies his nose off screen. Later that night, the high-speed pursuit of an ice cream truck arrives in his neighborhood, and Kevin witnesses the chase as it's broadcast on television and sees the opportunity to create a viral video. He is too late to shoot footage, however, watching the truck speed past his house, though he sees Iris wander outside in a daze after receiving a mysterious video call, then disappearing when his back is turned. After witnessing the truck run over a cop that had asked him to back away from the road, Kevin chases after the truck, egged on by images of a panicking Iris broadcast to his cell phone. Kevin's continued pursuit of the truck as it repeatedly circles the neighborhood carries on throughout the film, during which people receive strange images on their cell phones that cause them to become violently insane. The film then transitions to the first segment, Dante the Great, which is directed by Greg Bishop. This is probably the most confusing of the stories in this film, as it's kind of framed as an investigative documentary with interviews of magic experts, theater critics, law enforcement officials, and the main character all kind of intermingled with the main story, so it gets fucking confusing. But anyway, John McMullen, a trailer park resident and untalented illusionist, discovers a cloak that was once owned by Harry Houdini. John discovers that wearing the cloak grants him the power to perform actual magic, and taking on the stage name Dante the Great, John uses his newfound ability to perform in front of large audiences, becoming immensely famous. However, John learns that the cloak requires regular human sacrifices to work, and to that end, he hires a series of female assistants and videotapes them as he utters an incantation and watches the cloak devour them. He also uses his powers to summon and kill Clay Boland, the abusive boyfriend of Scarlet Kay, his latest assistant. When Scarlet discovers John's collection of tapes in a secret compartment in his dressing room, she alerts the police, though John is Though John is able to use his powers to escape custody. By a detective, John uses his newfound powers to summon her from the police station. A SWAT team bursts in to arrest John, but John manages to use his magic to kill every single one of them. He then proceeds to duel with Scarlet over the magic cloak. Though Scarlet is briefly able to take it from him, John overpowers her and recovers it. And before John can kill her, Scarlet uses a trick he taught her to immobilize him, prompting the cloak to feed on him instead. Scarlet then burns the cloak, only to find it in her house, hanging on her closet door. As she investigates, a pair of demonic arms reach out from inside the cloak and then grab her. This whole fucking movie is pretty fucking weak, but this is one of the weaker stories in it. It's just really kind of stupid and doesn't really make sense, and it doesn't really explain a goddamn thing. But anyway, we then cut back to the wraparound story where Kevin and the police continue pursuing the truck. A group of teenagers attempt to film the chase from atop a nearby bridge, with one of them staring at his phone in a trance while his nose bleeds. Another one of the teenagers then ends up clipping and falling from the bridge when he gets too close, being run over in the process. Kevin is halted by a group of cyclists, but they end up helping him pursue the truck when one of them is caught on it, has his feet shredded to the bone, and is ultimately killed. Despite this, Kevin continues his mission to save Iris, and then the film transitions to the next segment, Parallel Monsters, which is directed by Nacho Vigalondo. The segment opens up in Spain, where Alfonso, an inventor, works late on his newest project, promising his wife Marta that he will come to bed soon. His project is revealed to be a prototype interdimensional portal, and upon activating the portal, it opens to reveal what appears to be his garage. Alfonso witnesses a copy of himself look at him from the other side, revealing that the portal has successfully opened a gateway to a parallel world. The two versions of Alfonso cautiously greet each other, overcome by curiosity, and discover that they appear to be completely identical. The two then agree to trade places and cross through the portal with their own cameras to explore and document each other's worlds for 15 minutes. As the main Alfonso explores the alternate version of his house, it would seem that the two worlds are exact mirror duplicates. The main Alfonso then encounters a parallel version of Marta, who introduces him to two men, both named Oriol. In the living room, a porn snuff film plays on a television, and a sack of organs is displayed in the center of the room. The parallel Marta prompts Alfonso to perform a ceremony with the Orioles. Disturbed, the main Alfonso leaves the house and witnesses a large blimp with an inverted cross that blares demonic chanting, revealing that the two worlds hold two different dominant religions. When he attempts to record the blimp, he gets spotted by the two Orioles, who chase Alfonso before finally catching him. Their eyes and mouth turn bright red, and one of the Orioles takes his pants off to reveal that he has a fin creature in place of his penis. Back in the main world, the parallel Alfonso discovers the main Marta asleep, growing aroused and taking photos of her before unveiling his own monster's dick, scaring Marta awake. In the parallel world, the main Alfonso manages to stab the Oriole's penis with a screwdriver and flees back to the house, where the parallel Marta takes off her robe to reveal that she also has a similarly demonic pussy. Terrified, Alfonso punches her and flees back to his world, where the parallel Alfonso, covered in blood after his encounter with the main Marta, stabs his normal self. The parallel Marta appears and devours the parallel Alfonso with her fanged pussy before the main Alfonso closes the portal. The main version of Marta, also covered in blood, then stabs Alfonso to death after thinking that he savagely attacked her. This is one of the better stories in the movie, even though it's really not all that good. And once again, it gets confusing as fuck because it jumps from one world to the next, and you kind of forget what the hell is going on in each other's worlds. And then, of course, we jump back to the wraparound, where Kevin continues to pursue the truck as it continues to circle the neighborhood, begging the police to help him save Iris. Meanwhile, a group of Hispanic gangbangers are holding a barbecue to celebrate one of their own being released from prison. And seeing the police helicopter that has been broadcasting a chase, one of them assumes that his girlfriend has turned him in. Suddenly, the music playing on the radio raps and turns operatic, causing the guest of honor to become violent and murder the others by stabbing them all with forks. As the truck and Kevin pass, it is revealed that a gas tank has ruptured into chaos, causing the party to go up in an enormous fireball. And then we go into the last segment, Bone Storm, which is directed by Justin Benson and Aaron Scott Moorhead. Jason and Danny are a pair of skateboarders in Los Angeles who perform various stunts in the hopes of creating an epic skateboard video. The videographer they hire, Taylor, pushes them into increasingly dangerous circumstances in the hopes that they injure or kill themselves so he can film the aftermath and sell it as a snuff film. After they start a fight at a local skate park, the skaters become bored, and Taylor suggests that they continue the film shoot in Tijuana, remembering that he heard about a prime skating location for them to finish their video. Taylor calls out to their friend Sean and rope him into joining them in their trip to Mexico by paying for everything with his dad's credit card. After enjoying themselves and buying fireworks, the skaters subsequently become lost and run into a mysterious woman. Once they find a suitable place, an old flood channel, Taylor encourages them to perform more stunts, and when one of the skateboarders injures himself and bleeds on a large pentagram drawn on the ground, his blood quickly boils despite the apparent normal temperature of the pavement on which the pentagram is drawn. The skaters then discover the woman they met earlier standing nearby, and as Taylor introduces himself and offers to film her, she suddenly tears his fucking arm off. Immediately after, a group of cloaked cultists who were using the channel as a site for demonic worship discover the skaters and attack them. Using a pistol and their skateboards, the skateboarders kill the cultists, though Taylor is set on fire and Sean is killed in the fight. As a demonic roar sounds, the dead cultists rise as reanimated skeletons and mount a second attack. During the second attack, Jason and Danny use the fireworks they brought earlier to destroy several of the skeletons, and the two proceed to skate back towards the border as the creature the cultists were attempting to summon appears from a storm drain. The creature then eats the wounded Taylor along with his camera, and we cut back to the wraparound, where the news broadcasting the chase is warning that several fires have broken out across the city. Kevin still continues to chase the truck, and at one point encountering a woman in a trance with her nose bleeding. Kevin tries to get a taxi cab to stop, but the driver refuses to, and the driver also helps his friend, a porn director, film a striptease with a young woman in the back seat. Suddenly, the woman pulls a gun on him, revealing that the director had previously sold pornographic footage of her by her ex, and the exposure had apparently ruined her life. She forces him to strip by threatening to shoot his crotch. The director fights back, strangling her, but all three are killed when a police car flips through the air and crushes a taxi. And then we cut back to an epilogue of sorts where at dawn, Kevin finally catches up to the truck. He finds it sitting in the empty river basin he had been filming Iris near at the beginning of the film, body parts strewn all over the ground around it. He examines the driver's seat only to find it empty, with a pair of disembodied hands duct taped to the wheel. Upon examining the back of the truck, he finds a number of televisions stacked atop each other, as in the first two movies. Iris then appears on one of the TV screens and demands that Kevin upload the footage to broadcasters and the internet as well. At first he refuses, mentioning the videos are causing people all over the city to go insane. But when Iris begins to brutally mutilate herself, he relents and pushes a button labeled upload. With the deed done, he exits the truck as the image of Iris on the screen continues to taunt him, and outside he discovers Iris having actually been dead for quite some time, slumped against the truck with her cell phone stuck in her mouth. Kevin pulls the phone out of her mouth and sees that it is in selfie mode, and he stares in shock at himself on the screen with his nose bleeding, implying he is affected by the videos as well. The closing shot of the movie, set to the finale of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, is a view of the Los Angeles skyline, smoke billowing up, lights flickering on and off, and the helicopter circling overhead, revealing the uploaded videos have gone viral and have begun to affect thousands, thus fulfilling the grander threat introduced in the first two films. This, in my opinion, is the weakest entry in this entire franchise. It's pretty fucking shitty, and it's pretty bad. I mean, the gore effects, the practical effects, everything in this just sucks. Compared to the first two films, the acting is complete shit, and the stories just don't really work. You know, the whole theme of the tapes from the first two movies going viral in this one is just fucking stupid. Because you can't upload things to the internet from a fucking VHS tape. That makes no goddamn sense whatsoever. So yeah, this is the worst in the franchise in my opinion, and I would avoid it at all cost. IMDb gave it a 4.2 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 34%, Letterboxd a 2 out of 5, and I give it a half star out of 5. And that brings us to 2016 spin-off movie, Siren.
Anything getting back to the bride-to-be?
I know a place. We'll probably get you in. This is a bad idea.
Where the hell are we?
Don't lose him.
Whoa, 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 whoa. He's turning. Follow him.
Welcome.
Yes. Happy stag party! Ladies and gentlemen, we have some first-timers with us tonight.
What do you call this?
Murder.
Gentlemen, what do you want?
Something wild.
I have just the thing.
As I mentioned, this is a kind of a spin-off, if you will, of the Amateur Night, which was the first segment in the first VHS film. It is 1 week before his wedding day, and Jonah and his groomsmen hit the town for his stag party, hosted by his irresponsible brother, Mac. Attempting to be more original, Mac takes him to Garden City instead of a typical party location, hoping for a wild night, and instead they wind up at a lackluster strip club. Visibly disappointed at his efforts, Mac attracts the attention of a stranger who tells him about an underground moving club that promises to surpass all expectations. Reluctantly, Jonah agrees to go, but the long drive to 50 North, 40 West through a dark forest unnerves the group, as does the club when they finally arrive. The patrons and dancers almost convince the group to leave until the club owner, Mr. Nix, comes out to personally welcome and see to their entertainment. Upon hearing that, Jonah wants a non-cheating experience, and Nix takes him into another room and tells him to go to the window at the end while his groomsmen pay. He asks from each of the three men their favorite memories of their mothers, and at the window, Jonah sees a nude young woman on the other side of the glass who begins singing. Jonah suddenly relives all the sexual encounters he's ever had all at once. While meanwhile, at the main bar, one of the groomsmen, Elliot, has a custom drink with the leech in it, and suddenly experiences the memory of murdering someone, after which both Mac and Rand realize they all have matching marks on the back of their necks. After leaving the window, Jonah hears a girl ask him not to leave and sees that the door to the room is padlocked from the outside. Fearing that the girl is a sex slave, Jonah gets Rand, tells the others to get to the car, and the two break the lock and let her out using the Swiss Army knife that Jonah gave them as groomsmen's gifts. While attempting to sneak out of the club, the three get waylaid by guards and hide in a bathroom, and once there, the girl uses the key she stole from one of the guards to open a shackle around her ankle, then brutally kills the guard that followed them, revealing claws and a long tail. Jonah and Rand run for the car and the four drive away, only for the girl to suddenly land on the roof and cause them to crash. While the girl grabs Elliot and drags him off, Nix and his posse arrive and kidnap Rand as Jonah and Mac escape. Back at the club, Nix questions Rand, asking why they released Lilith before allowing the brother of the murdered guard to torture him. Out in the woods, Jonah and Mac desperately try to find Elliot while arguing over who is to blame for the way the night has gone. And Jonah realizes that the girl had sniffed him after being released, and had gone after Elliot because he had been wearing his jacket. The two then attempt to cover their scent, managing to escape and find their way to a dinner party, or to a diner patroned by a pair of cops. They desperately try to describe the past few hours, and the cops cut them off, not believing them. Mac noticing in alarm that they have the same mark on the backs of their necks, realizing that they work for Nix. The girl arrives at the diner and starts to sing, entrancing the cop with Jonah, who quickly puts in his headphones to drown her out. Watching as she murders both cops and chasing them through the diner, the girl reveals a demonic face, announcing, "I like you," if you remember that line from the Amateur Night segment, like once again, in the first VHS film, before grabbing Jonah and flying away. Back at the club, Nix orders one of his minions, who appears to be some sort of Gorgon. If you don't know what that is, just think Medusa, the lady with snakes in her hair. To take a very injured Rand's memories of being tortured, hunt down Jonah, and give them to him. The minion does this by taking a Medusa-like leech from her head and inserting into, then removing it from the mark on the back of his neck, revealing what happened earlier when paying for Jonah's session, and what happened with Elliot, implying that part of Nix's business is selling people's memories. Back with Jonah, he and a girl land in a quarry, and after a few attempts to escape, she rapes him while singing, again creating a fantasy of him having sex with his fiancée, Eva, and then forms her tail into a dick-like shape and inserts it into his ass, to make him impregnate her. Jonah runs from the now sleeping girl and makes it back to his hotel room where the minion is waiting for him. She forces him to drink the leech he took earlier, and Jonah relives Rand's torture and memory of Nix speaking directly to him and offering a trade, the girl for Rand. All he has to do is go to a church, and the girl will follow him. Jonah agrees and follows the minion to the church. Once there, a few things become clear. The girl Lily is actually a demon from hell, a succubus to be exact, that was summoned years ago, imprisoned by Nix, and forced to become a sex slave. Lily had become infatuated with Jonah because he was kind and helped her escape. Succubi mate for life, and Lily wants him to stay with her, killing anyone who will get in her way. The church is the location where she was originally summoned, and Nix needs Jonah to lure her into a ruined circle and reattach the shackle around her ankle to bind her will to his again, as he is the only person she will not kill. Lily arrives and hesitantly steps into the circle. Jonah then apologizes to Lily that he made a mistake when he released her, letting her know that he was not aware that it was a trap. To Nix's anger, Jonah makes a new deal with Lily, that he will not put the shackle on if she will let Jonah go. Lily agrees and proceeds to slaughter Nix and his henchmen, While Jonah grabs a seriously injured Rand, Mac arrives and sacrifices himself, saving his brother from a vengeful Nyx, and Millie kisses Jonah goodbye and watches from above the church doors while Jonah and Rand leave. We then jump to a year later, where Jonah and Eva are married. Eva states that she wants to start their special evening soon because she is getting sleepy as she takes a drink of her wine. They make love on their anniversary, and Jonah goes to get a glass of water afterwards and sees Eva sleeping on the couch, realizing that he had made love to Lily and not Eva. Jonah attempts to get Lily to leave and almost succeeds, until Eva notices Lily and starts to scream, whereupon Lily starts to attack her. Jonah then begs her to stop and says he will go with her, and Lily grabs Jonah and they fly off into the night, Eva hysterically screaming after them as the movie ends. This isn't the most enjoyable movie, but it does show hints of excellence, and it is for a very select demographic. It's for people that liked the first segment, as I keep saying, in the first VHS movie, and wanted to see it made into a full-length film. The acting in this is mainly a miss, with a couple of exceptions, and the story does have its cliches. And it has a few interesting concepts presented, but they're not really fleshed out enough. But the main reason people should watch this, if they're interested, is for Lily, who is played by, what was her name? Hannah Fearman, I believe, who played Lily in Amateur's Night. And she does a pretty excellent job of portraying Lily. Like I said, it's the main reason to watch this movie, if you're going to watch it. And it does also have some gore in it, not a lot. Well, there's a fair amount of gore, I'd say. But like I always say, gore doesn't make for a good movie. And there are a few rather creepy shots of Lily when she's in her succubi form. So that's also another reason to watch it, because those scenes, there are some scenes that are fairly fucking creepy. IMDb gave it a 5.3 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes at 65%, Letterboxd at 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a 3 out of 5. And that brings us to the final film, and that is 2021's VHS 94.
Just press the button.
That's the red button.
Just press it.
I assume they're paying extra for this.
Yes.
This is a remarkable story.
Hello? Hello?
Turns your vegetables into a tasty, mouth-watering paste.
We, of course, open with the wraparound segment, this one titled Holy Hell, where a white-dressed woman inhales vapor from a white, goopy substance on her hands. Later, the same woman, with her eyes gouged out, counts down from 10 in a staticky voice as another woman passes behind her. A SWAT team consisting of Slater, Ousler, Sprayberry, Spivy, Petro, and Nash, and their cameraman Gary, raid a warehouse during what is believed to be a drug bust. They find a private jet behind the warehouse and a distorted female voice emanates from the speakers, saying, "All are welcome, all are watching. Finally, followers, tonight is a night you've been waiting for. Track my signal. The signal is the stimulant. The signal is the sedative. The signal is salvation." As the officers charge through the tight corridors, they discover multiple prison cell-like rooms with television sets displaying static. They spot a man sitting in one of the rooms, but as the officers order him not to move, they realize he is dead, with his eyes gouged out, and the white goopy substance the drug SWAT team is after, dripping onto the floor. Advancing through the warehouse in search of suspects, the team enters the room seen in the VHS tape and encounter more dead cultists. Slater orders to search the upper floor with the blue team, while the remaining officers keep going as one of the televisions begins to play a newscast. And this leads us into the first segment, Storm Drain, which is directed by Chloe Okuno. Channel 6 news reporter Holly Marciano and her cameraman Jeff are filming a story about the Rat Man, a cryptid of local legend who has supposedly been living in the town's storm drains. After interviewing several of the town's citizens who have reportedly witnessed the creature to gain information, the duo descend into a storm drain where they find several homeless encampments. While filming, they are approached by a man covered in black slime, and Holly tries to interview him, but when he begins to spit up black liquid and murmurs "Ratma," they attempt to flee. Before they can make their escape, they are captured by other residents of the sewers. They are then taken deeper into the sewers by the dwellers. The minister of the local church, who Holly had interviewed earlier, appears and announces that a new order will soon begin. He then summons a rat man, which is revealed to be a grotesque half-human, half-rat creature dubbed Ratma, that he and the other sewer dwellers worship as a god. Ratma proceeds to vomit black liquid, which the minister pours over Jeff's face, burning him to death. Holly is then brought before Ratma, the creature growling in approval as Holly screams. And then, for some fucking reason, we're shown a brief infomercial for the Veggie Masher. And then the film returns to the newscast, where Holly's co-anchor explains that she was rescued from the storm drain and has returned to work at the station, though Jeff is still missing. Holly gives her next report, unwittingly substituting random words with Ratma, confusing her co-anchor. She then suddenly vomits the black liquid on his face, burning him to death on air. As the newsroom erupts into panic, Holly, revealed to have been successfully converted/brainwashed by the sewer cult, cheerfully finishes her report, sending off with "Hail Ratma." We then cut to the wraparound, where the officers go deeper into the building and come across a room set up to look like a church, with a giant screen at the front and severed mannequins in the seats. The giant screen begins to play video footage from a funeral home, and that leads into The Empty Wake, which is directed by Simon Barrett. Opening at Jensen Funeral Home, where a young woman named Haley is assigned to host the wake for a man named Andrew Edwards, Andrew's family has requested that Andrew's wake be video recorded during the whole night. Haley's boss, Ronald, and another assistant, Tim, leave the building for the night, leaving Haley to pass the time reading. A strong thunderstorm begins outside, causing the power to flicker on and off. Haley then calls her friend Sharon, asking for her to check in the local obituaries for Andrew's name. When she hears strange noises from the casket, which has moved by itself, Haley calls Tim and says that she thinks Andrew might still be alive in the casket. Tim quells her worries by explaining that the body is most likely releasing gases that are causing the noises, and as the storm worsens, the building begins to occasionally lose power. A strange man, who identifies himself as Gustav and claims to be a relative of Andrew, arrives to the wake, during which Haley allows him to pay his respects. After uttering an apparent incantation in Hungarian, Gustav thanks Haley for the opportunity and abruptly leaves. Sometime later, Sharon reveals to Haley that Andrew had committed suicide by leaping from the roof of a church after shouting gibberish. The power cuts off again, plunging the building into darkness as the noises resume from the casket. Trying to leave, Haley discovers the front doors are chained shut, and returning to the viewing room, she finds the casket tipped over and open. She is then attacked by Andrew's reanimated corpse, but because the top of its head is missing, it cannot see her. Hiding behind the casket, she finds the top of Andrew's head, and Andrew's functional eyes lock onto her, allowing the rest of his corpse to find Haley. As it attacks, the storm, which has escalated into a tornado, strikes the funeral home as the camera cuts out. After it passes, Haley, having either been zombified or possessed by Andrew's spirit, rises and crawls through the window. We then go back to the wraparound, where the officers discover body parts strewn all across the fucking floor, mannequins in the toilet stalls, and upside-down crosses hanging from the ceiling of various rooms. Panicked, they plan to exit the building, and as an unknown voice states, "Forever is right now," a television begins to play footage from a bizarre laboratory, which leads us into the next story, The Subject, which is directed by Timo. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the last name. In Indonesia, a man wakes up to find his body gone and replaced by mechanical spider legs. He falls from his restraints and catches fire, which is soon extinguished by Dr. James Suhendra, a deranged scientist who desires a successful mechanical human hybrid, using kidnapped humans as guinea pigs. He carries out a lobotomy on a young woman with the initials SA, who is referred to as Subject 99, using a circular saw, and sedates a restrained young man referred to as Subject 98 after he wakes up early. Both experiments are successful. Subject 98 becomes a large robot with spring-powered blades for arms, and SA becomes a functioning cyborg that responds to speech. The rest of the tape is mostly presented from her point of view. James celebrates SA's success, and a news report states that a rash of recent disappearances are driving wedges between the police and the public. James is suspected of kidnapping his patients, and SA's old self is shown on screen, and James remarks on how she still recognizes her old appearance. James then attempts to wipe SA's memories. SA wakes up during the procedure and hits James before attempting to undo her restraints. James beats SA repeatedly with a metal tray, and her battery life drops before he is interrupted by a knock at the door, and a team of heavily armored police officers have arrived to arrest James. James throws a blanket over SA as the officers break in, as the tape cuts to timid cameraman Jono's feed. After the commander confirms that James is their suspect, the police shoot him dead and begin hunting the lab for survivors. They discover SA and argue over whether she should be killed or kept alive, as she is not classified as human anymore, despite technically being a survivor. A sudden blackout occurs in the lab, and Jono witnesses SA escape, but does not say anything. Another officer attempts to shoot the door lock and free the group, but triggers an explosion. As the group comes to, an alarm begins to sound, and James' contingency plan begins. Over a speaker, James states that its creation is his alone, and that those who try to take it from him shall die. Subject 98 awakens and slaughters most of the soldiers. Jono and the commander survive after the commander hurls a grenade at 98. SA then comes to and flees through the building, being shot at by the surviving officers and chased by 98. She locks herself in a small room and finds blueprints for her cyborg body and cannon arm, along with the upper half of her head and face preserved in a jar of formaldehyde. She approaches a mirror and sees her new form for the first time, and enraged, she punches the mirror and breaks it. After leaving the room and coming across more of James' failed experiments, SA fights her way through the building, slaughtering any soldiers she comes across in self-defense. She discovers Jono behind a door and spares him after he begs for his life and promises to help her out of the lab. Suddenly, the commander appears and shoots SA before beating her. Jono grabs a gun and shoots the commander dead before being attacked by Subject 98. With her battery critically low, SA uses the last of her strength to tear out 98's brain, killing it. She then collapses next to a heavily injured Jono, and her battery finally dies. The tape cuts to a security camera, which shows SA standing up on her own accord, escaping from the lab. And then back to the wraparound, it is shown that Nash and Petro have kidnapped Spivey. As the rest of the team frantically search for him, Nash states, "Forever starts right now," and in front of a wall of TV screens. Slater pages his missing teammates over his radio, and Pietro states that he should not lose his head. Slater suddenly collapses and enters a trance in front of one of the screens, which proceeds to display footage of a snowy fortified militia enclosure. And that leads us into the final story of the film, Terror, which is directed by Ryan Prowse, which involves the First Patriots Movement Militia, which is an extremist group that are currently plotting to blow up a government building in a bid to take back America. It is shown that they live in a well-secured compound in a deserted area somewhere in Detroit, Michigan. The compound has room for security cameras as well as a heavily protected small room covered in wooden crosses. In the latter room, a man is chained up and kept prisoner. Bob, the group's cameraman, Greg, the group leader, and Chuck, a group member, enter the room, and the man pleads for his life, but Greg shoots him at point-blank range. The film then cuts to one of the group's propaganda videos, where Greg explains that the group intends to purge evil from America. Members of the group set out in a car and drive past the building, which they plan to blow up, surveying the site for security cameras and possible entry points. Back at the compound, Slater from the framing segment arrives to supply guns and ammunition to the group, asking if they have tested the quote-unquote creature. It is shown that the group regularly shoot the man, who is revealed to be a vampire, and siphon his blood, which becomes explosive when exposed to sunlight, planning to use said blood instead of a bomb. Wanting to test it to see if their plan works, they inject a rabbit with some of the vampire's blood and cage it. When the sun rises, the rabbit explodes. In celebration at night, the group drinks heavily and party. Bob enters the compound and visits Steve, who is sitting in the security camera room. The pair visit the vampire's corpse, and Bob goads Steve into kissing it. The head then falls forward and showers Steve in blood as Bob laughs. The next morning, an emergency bell rings and alerts the members of the group. Greg berates Jimmy, who was supposed to be on duty guarding the compound, and Jimmy runs towards the body behind the truck, discovering it to be Terry, his neck having been badly gored. Suddenly, crashes come from inside the compound, and the group realizes they are missing Steve. Greg calls for Steve. Just as a severed head is thrown out of the compound entrance, as roars come from inside. One of them begins firing a truck-mounted machine gun on the compound, losing control due to the sway and killing some of the group in the process, and is then shot in the head by Tom when he is unable to stop. Steve then stumbles out of the compound covered in the vampire's blood, promptly exploding once he steps into the daylight. The remaining members of the group, Greg, Tom, Bob, and Jimmy, vow to kill the vampire. They then enter the compound and discover the creature hiding in the attic. It tears Tom's face off, and Greg shoots wildly at it while in the attic. The vampire kills Jimmy by slamming his head on the floor repeatedly, and Bob shoots at it, missing and shooting Greg in the leg. Bob is then attacked by the vampire, dying after his face is bitten off, and Greg, repeating the phrase, "Christ is King," is dragged by the vampire into the cage. It then opens the attic window and lets in sunlight, causing the vampire to explode and the compound to be destroyed. We then cut to the final part of the wraparound, where the majority of the SWAT team are now dead, their eyes having been gouged out. Slater is tied to a chair by Pietro and Nash, who call him out for supplying the militia in the previous video with guns. The women explain that they are members of the snuff fetish film cult that has been operating out of the warehouse, where they create and distribute videotapes depicting animal cruelty, cannibalism, and other shocking acts of violence. Slater is told that he will be their final kill for this video, whereupon Pietro beats him to death with the video camera. As the film ends, she and Nash believe this will be their best tape yet and wonder what to call it. Originally made as the streaming service Shudder's one of their original movies. This is a return to form for the franchise after, let's see, 2, 3, if you include Siren. Really shitty, well, Siren wasn't shitty, but the Viral and Jesus Christ. But after viral, and I guess to his rather shittiness, I guess you would call it, this was, like I said, a return to form. It's gory as shit. And while most of the stories do work, there's one or two out of the five that really don't. But there are some rather creepy as hell scenes to be found in this. And there's a couple that are actually kind of disturbing when you really watch it. So it's back to the days of the first film where it was made to scare you. And wasn't just full of stupid fucking jump scares like 2 and Viral were. But like I said, this is probably my second favorite in the franchise. Well, it is my second favorite of the franchise. And like I said, if you're a gorehound, this is the entry for you to watch. IMDb gave this a 5.5 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a very surprising 90%. Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5, and I give it a 4.5 out of 5. And that just about wraps it up for me, guys. As always, you can reach out to me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. And that does it. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.